Welcome to another episode of Superpower State of Mind with me, Marlin Anderson. Now, the death of a friend as a teenager has shaped Alexandra's career choices in life. As a barrister, she now specialises in the family courts, and in this really enlightening conversation with me, we speak about that early experience and the impact it had, the issues within the UK justice system, and how, not only being a woman, but a woman of colour, you need more resilience than your peers. I really hope you're enjoying Superpower State of Mind. Please do hit follow and leave a review as it helps others discover the podcasts. Over to my conversation with Alexandra Wilson, aka the Essex Barrister. Right, hello Alex. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. And thanks for having me.
My podcast is all about empowering women, and you are such a powerful role model to women everywhere. And that is literally why I wanted you to come on. You are amazing. So it's going to be an interesting chat.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
How's your week been? I heard you're off to America very soon.
Yeah, it's been hectic because I've been in court all week and I'm literally flying next Wednesday, which I appreciate people listening won't appreciate how soon that is, but that's less than a week away. There's so many things that I need to sort out. You know, just even dental and healthcare in the States is so expensive. So I'm just trying to book in all my checkups, you know, just trying to get everything checked before
I go. My brother lives in LA. He moved out there about 15 years ago and he's been there ever since. And my goal is to move out into America as well. And He was like, Marlin, the healthcare. I was like,
I know. It's just everything's private. You know, you have to, even just getting health insurance is like a new foreign idea to me. I'm just like, oh my God, I have to pay for this. So it's just kind of getting my head around the fact that things are going to be very different for the next year, and it makes you realize how much we take the NHS for granted. You know, that you could just ring up and get an appointment. It's just, yeah, crazy.
So you've got quite the career, and I appreciate you're super busy, so thank you so much for taking the time out. So yeah, I mean, where did it all begin? What was your childhood like? Tell me more about yourself, your background, what kind of upbringing you had, and did it influence where you are now?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm one of four. I'm the eldest, which I'm sure my siblings would say explains why I'm so bossy and just like driven. It was definitely a childhood of me trying to get my siblings to do whatever I wanted, to be honest. So my dad is, his parents are Jamaican and they came here, you know, part of the Windrush generation. My dad was actually born here, but some of his siblings were born in Jamaica. So we've always had quite close links to Jamaica growing up. You know, my dad was the main person to cook. I'm sure my mum will kill me for this, but she can't really cook. So, she really can't. So, it was always my dad. So, we grew up, yeah, like quite connected to our Caribbean side. And then, yeah, my mum grew up here and her family's English. So, yeah, I'd say we kind of grew up with a strong sense of a mixed identity. Really strangely, actually, my cousins on my mum's side are all mixed race as well. So our whole family is quite mixed. We have like a really, really mixed family. As children, we grew up in East London, Essex border. I always say the border because whenever I say one or the other, people try to tell me it's not one or the other, you know? So I grew up in a place called South Woodford, which...
I know South Woodford.
You know South Woodford, yeah.
Yeah, South Woodford. There's a few and Turkish grills around there.
Oh, yeah, there are some delicious Turkish grills around. I still come back for the Turkish grills because they're really good. So it's kind of the border. So the postcode is East London, but it felt, you know, it does have an Essex vibe and it's right on the edge, like where
I can hear a twang in your accent. I can hear a bit of Essex.
My school was in Woodford Green. The next area is Essex, so, and my schools were always in Woodford Green. So, and then my family slowly moved out, actually, so now they don't even live on a tube line anymore. They've gone so far into Essex, it's not covered by the tube. So I used to always say, you know, they're just moving down the tube, but now they're off the tube.
Like zone Z on the tube.
Exactly. Like fully, like it's a train, not a tube anymore, you know. So yeah, I grew up around there. Went to a state school in Essex where I'd say learning was not the like first thing on the agenda. I think that there was a lot, you know, I look back now probably with a bit more of a realistic perspective on what I was like at school, and I almost certainly was nerdy. I used to try and paint this gloss over it and be like, yeah, I think I was a quite cool nerd, but I don't think I was. I think I was
a nerd too, though. I was always in the library. Like always, right? Yeah. I was a quiet kid, man. Like I lacked self confidence, and I had these big glasses. I had a tash, you know, sideburn. Little boy.
Sounds like me. I was like not cool either. I had like frizzy curly hair. Like definitely went through acne. Like having acne for like a lot of my teenage years. Yes, I was not the sight. I had braces. You know, It was not the look. But you know, good things come to those who wait. So I feel like over time, it's got better. Well, I like to think so anyway. But yeah, so school was interesting. It definitely, yeah, like I say, it wasn't... I think that I realised this once I got to university, that like some people had gone to schools where it was cool to be clever. You know, that it was like... people wanted to be the cleverest, people wanted to do really well, people wanted to get into the best unis. And when I compare it to my school, I'm like, people wanted to like have the best makeup, or like, you know, have the coolest boyfriend, or be on the like netball team. You know, that was like the cool things to do. It definitely wasn't like who can get into the best uni. So it was a bit of a culture shock. And then just kind of finishing off my childhood, I guess. I did go to uni. I went to Oxford, which, yeah, as I say, it was a big shock to the system. This little girl from Essex turning up in Oxford, being like, hey, you're right, everyone. And yeah, being quite a surprise to the system. But, that's kind of, it's kind of my journey of my childhood. I mean, I think something I would probably say affected me a lot just before I went to uni, and I guess kind of led me to the job I'm doing now, was a close friend of mine was killed, or a family friend, you know, kind of called him a cousin, was killed when we were 17, so not long before going off to uni. And that definitely, you know, I think all the, you know, the trivial stuff of growing up and, you know, being a teenage girl and going off to a whole new city, all of that was like enough of like a stress. But then when he was killed, I think it kind of just twisted everything like upside down and kind of really made me think, actually, oh my god, like life is so precious. Like I'd never ever imagined at like 17 I'd be losing a friend, you know. So that was probably like a big thing that happened actually just before I went to uni, but that kind of shaped everything.
Grief is like hard to accept at any age, let alone a teenager, when you're still like going through the motions and, you know, turning into a young adult. And when you lose someone, you don't really expect to lose anyone when you're young, right? So it's a shock to the system. So do you think that really kind of put more into your head of where you wanted to go in the direction of your career then?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I completely agree with what you say about grief. And I think that, I mean, even now as an adult, I struggle with it. And I know you've gone through some grief as well, and I can only say that like I'm always looking to learn from other people, because I think grief is like, it's just so different. I lost my nan earlier this year. My nan was like, honestly, she was like my best friend, you know, like we were really close. And I think that even now it's like looking back at how I dealt with grief as a teenager and how I deal with grief now, I don't think there's like a right way, you know, like you kind of think, oh, as I get older, it's going to be easier. I'm going to learn how to deal with grief. Like I'm going to be able to combat it. I'm going to be strong. I'm going to be able to put it together. And it's just unrealistic. I think it's something that is always, always hard to deal with.
100%. It comes in waves. Like one day you're
it
okay.
It does, doesn't it?
Like remind you of the person. And for me, you know, I think because I lost both my parents and my daughter in like in a close short period of time, I think grief is trauma, right? And so our trauma responses are all very different, and the way we react to different things and stuff. And I think it's an ongoing healing process, and we'll get to it in a minute, but with your job and what you do, you must see so many different traumatic things on a regular, right? Where you have to put your own personal life to one side and focus on work. And so it's hard. Do you know what I mean? I can't imagine.
Yeah, completely. No. I think you've hit the nail on the head completely. I think one of the things that I found difficult, like losing my nan this year, was that I was working full time. You know, it's one thing. I think that's why I say grief is, you know, it's never dealing with it better or worse. It's just different things in your life are happening. So, you know, when I was a teenager, I was so naive and young, and it was the complete shock, and trying to process that while also, you know, going through the kind of motions of being a teenager, going off to university, you know, like making friends, losing friends, you know, like in the kind of like way kids do, you know, that kind of immaturity that I don't necessarily feel when I've lost you, or I haven't felt when I lost my nan recently. But there's a completely different thing. Like you were just saying, you know, now I'm working full time, and I was like, I actually have to sometimes, you know, there were days where I was like, when we talk about waves, you know, there were days when I was like, oh my God, I do not want to get out of bed today. Like, I just miss her. I'm feeling so sad. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to be like, okay, suck it up, put on your work face and go to work and deal with someone else's problems.
Yeah, you know? But you're out here helping all these other people. Yeah. So, you know, where does the line like come where you just need to help yourself sometimes? And it's difficult, right?
Well, one of the things that I think at the bar, so we often say at the bar in real life, it doesn't actually mean anything to like normal people, but at the bar is just like an expression to describe like amongst barristers. So, you know, and at the bar, there's been a bit more of a push in the last kind of couple of years to properly consider well-being, you know, people to actually properly think about the fact that people are going through things in their personal life, and we're not just these robots that work for other people. We're human beings, you know what I mean? Like, we're human beings that, you know, actually are going through our own stuff. And I think there's been more of a push towards people getting things like therapy, you know, talking therapies, and actually having the confidence to do that, because I do think there's still this way that we present to the world, like we are just these, you know. So even sometimes I see barristers on Twitter and stuff, they'll talk about, oh, you know, if you've got mental, like there was someone who was talking about feeling really low and how they'd dropped out of the bar for a bit and come back, and there'd been some replies basically saying, oh, you might not be strong enough to do this job. And that's completely wrong, you know. Yeah, it's actually completely the wrong,
such an old mentality, right?
Exactly. And I completely
was talk early, I was like, this girl's so funny, you come out with like you love it, don't you? I'm gonna give you a follow in a bit.
Yeah, it's honestly like, I think that, you know, I think that it's exactly that. It's a dinosaur attitude, as I would say. It's like this idea that, like, do you know what I mean? They're like these people in the profession that just need to update their mentality or need to go, because actually I think our generation's so much better about like at talking about mental health, you know, and being like, actually it's completely normal to feel things like grief. It's actually completely normal to feel anxious. It's completely normal to feel depressed. And people should feel that they can talk about this stuff without being like, I'm going to be judged as not being good enough for my job. You know, I think so hopefully things are changing, like I say, with the new generations. But yeah, the dinosaurs need to go.
For those that don't know, what does your job involve? Being a barrister, I can't even imagine like what your day-to-day is like. Give me a little bit of a lowdown.
Yeah, of course. So as of January, I've specialised purely in family law. So prior to that, I was doing family and criminal law.
Wow. Okay.
And I've been doing that for the last 3-ish years. And then, yeah, this year I decided I wanted to specialise specifically in family. And so now, to be honest, there's still such a huge overlap, as I'm sure many listeners will appreciate, because one of the biggest areas that I deal with is domestic abuse. I think for me, the transition actually, like I said, I was doing both before anyway, but the transition hasn't been too hard because I'm still doing a lot of very similar stuff. So as some people may know, and if they don't, I'll just briefly explain, domestic abuse can be dealt with in the family and the criminal court. So if someone has, you know, if a perpetrator has done something that constitutes a criminal offence, which is a lot of domestic abuse ultimately, so whether it's a physical assault, whether it's, you know, there's so many crimes that kind of fit under the umbrella of domestic abuse, and yeah, it can be prosecuted in the criminal courts. Now that is obviously really important. But again, as some people may know, the criminal courts have a really high threshold. It's, you know, that if it's a jury or if it's magistrates or a judge, that they have to be sure of the person's guilt. And that's so difficult in domestic situations. Like, I can't emphasize enough. And again, I'm sure people can relate to this. Anyone who's had any dealings with the criminal justice system or even watched programs about it or knows someone who has, you know, sure is such a high standard. And often, you know, when it's one person's word against the other, that's really difficult. It's really, really difficult.
I wanted to ask you. So
yeah.
I'm an ambassador for Women's Aid and Refuge, and uh-huh. I had a court case with my ex-partner. Yeah. So this was about 3 years ago now, and he got arrested for common assault and GBH. And and I took it, you know, I went to the police after a long time of not, you know, going back and forth and getting back with him and whatnot. And he was messing with my head a lot throughout the process, and he pleaded, yeah. He pleaded guilty, and then he switched it to guilty last minute, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was told to do so. They do that quite tactfully. I can't even talk tactfully.
I don't think so, yeah.
At the end, in order to kind of see if the victim will change their mind.
Yeah.
I was going to go through either way. If I had to go to court, I would have gone to court. No, even though it would have been really like hard and scary for me, I would have done it. And I managed to get a bit of justice, but he got sentenced to a year and served 3 months because it was that good behaviour. He was let out, you know. And I was just thinking, I went through like 2 years of back and forth with police and I had lots of evidence and whatnot. And this guy is just out roaming about again. And I thought to myself, there is no justice here.
Yeah.
It just made my heart just sink, because you get that high of, oh, he's been sentenced. And I mean, a year is nothing for the pain he put me through. But, and I thought, God, wow, the guy's out after 3 months. Like, what? I mean, he wasn't allowed in certain areas, but I was like, yeah, I mean, it's not stopped him before. A restraining order never stopped him. And, you know, and you live with that fear constantly. And I know, yeah, I just feel like it's...
Yeah, I can completely. I think you are certainly not alone in your frustration of the justice system. I think there are a lot, and I was about to say women, and that's because it is predominantly women. You know, it's of course not always women, but it is predominantly women who are the victims of domestic abuse in the criminal justice system, for sure. And certainly in my experience, I mean, the vast majority. And I think that a lot of people feel like the justice system is failing them whether it's, like you say, the sentences seem so short sometimes that actually it doesn't seem to really capture the harm that has been caused. You know, you look at some offences and you see people going away for drugs for like 10 years or something. And then you're like, well, actually, this person's ruined my life. And, you know, they're going away for a much shorter period of time. So I definitely think that I can see people's frustration in that sphere. But also I think that there's a frustration because the process takes so long, you know, it takes so long from beginning to end, and it's that added trauma. I know we were talking about trauma earlier, but you know, from the point in which you've managed to get the confidence to go and speak to the police or speak to a women's charity or, you know, actually talk about the abuse that a person's been suffering, it takes so long to get to the end point of someone actually being sentenced. Sometimes years, you know, sometimes it'll be like 2 years later.
What's even like more frustrating? So I was part of a petition to basically, it was a time that you can report assault. So it was within 6 months to report common assault, and it's only just been changed now. So we get more time. And I thought, you know, if a victim has been raped or whatever's happened to them, they haven't had the courage to go forward, and it's post 6 months, like, you know, where the heck, like, what?
Yeah, I can completely see that, where there were the kind of statutory time limits, yeah, where there would be times where you're out of time suddenly, and then someone never ever has to take any accountability of their actions. No, I can completely see that frustration. And I think, yeah, the criminal justice system, as I'm sure you may have seen, is kind of folding. It's, you know, it's really struggling at the moment. There's criminal barristers on strike. There's not enough money in the system. I think there's not enough judges. There's not enough, you know, the courtrooms are all in a dire state. So I think the whole system is kind of falling apart. But what we really need to look at is there's people at the end of this. You know, it's not just a business. You know, there's actually people who are, and ultimately there's going to be terrible end effects if people don't have faith in the criminal justice system.
Do you think more women are coming forward now to report domestic abuse?
Yeah, well, I do, but like I said, because I've shifted into family, I actually see both. So I see men and women reporting it a lot more than I saw in just the criminal justice system, which I think is really interesting, because in the family courts, people will often talk about or make allegations about their domestic abuse or the domestic abuse that they experience in their relationship as a way of, you know, being able to spend more time with their children. Okay. And ultimately, And so a lot of people, the most important thing in their lives, completely understandably, is their children, right? And, you know, it might be that one parent has stopped another parent from seeing the children, and then they'll make an application to the court, and the court will ask them, you know, have you been a victim of domestic abuse? And I think being directly asked in that way makes people reflect on their relationship much more than, for example, they would in an ordinary life. You know, often we don't sit there thinking, you know, is this abusive, like, just on a daily basis. And so, you know, people might not think, okay, this is abusive, let me go and speak to the police about it. When you're confronted with an application in the family court and they specifically ask you that question, you know, has there been any domestic abuse, people are actually like, actually, I think this was abusive, and I think this was abusive. And so I find that in the family court, domestic abuse is used all the time by both men and women, as I say. And, you know, there are some patterns. So often you'll have men saying there's been some degree of parental alienation. That's like a word that's used a lot. So a mum often will have stopped them seeing their child, and that they're using the child as a form of abuse. So, for example, you know, if you don't do this, I won't let you see the child. If you don't do this, I won't, you know, and or just stopping them seeing the child. That, I would say, tends to be more common amongst fathers. And women, we tend to see the more traditional types of domestic abuse: physical, emotional, psychological, gaslighting, things like that. But like I say, it can be on both sides. And I definitely see it more often on both sides in the family court. Where the standard's lower, you don't have to be sure. So in the criminal courts, as I say, you have to be sure that the person's done whatever they're accused of doing. In the family courts, it's more likely than not. We call it the balance of probabilities, and it just means that, you know, essentially it's more than 50% likely that they did, which is a much lower standard, right? Yeah. A much, much lower standard.
So what about, because I see this happen a lot, when a mother is stuck in an abusive and financially controlling relationship where she can't leave, but then social services get involved and the kids get taken away because she is staying with the perpetrator, but there's a lot more to it because that is domestic abuse. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I do a lot of cases like that. So they kind of fall under the heading of care cases, like as in local authority care. And yeah, they're really, really difficult, where you've got, again, as you say, usually mums who are, they feel as though they're being punished for being abused. You know, their children are taken away because they're a victim of domestic abuse. I think the way that the local authorities see it, and so when I do this work, I sometimes act for mums, I sometimes act for dads, I sometimes act for the local authority, which is good because it gives you a kind of a view from all angles, if you see what I mean. And I think what local authorities would say is the priority is the children. And what they want to do is protect the children. And so if someone is in a relationship where their children are being exposed to that conflict, or even at risk of being at the end of that conflict, you know, if the children are being exposed more directly to being abused, that's a problem. And if the mum,
but don't you reckon that more support should be given to the victim and the child together, instead of taking the kid away? More support, like, they should be, you know what I mean? So, because I can't imagine how it feel like to be stuck in an abusive relationship, your child get taken away from you, but nothing's, you're not being helped in any way. And so you're left with like the aftermath.
Some local authorities are really good at doing that, to be fair. So some will offer that support first. So it's just, I hate to go back to the funding issue, but that is a big, big issue, because sometimes there's just not enough social workers to build up that rapport with a woman to, and like I say again, usually a woman, to get their trust, to say, look, you can call me if you're in danger. Look, this is a program you can do that will help you identify when it's a dangerous situation.
There's not enough at all.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, also sometimes the refuges are underfunded. And so women don't want to stay in a house with seven other women and their children, you know, sharing one kitchen and sharing one bathroom, you know, or two bathrooms or whatever it is. You know, sometimes those living conditions aren't great either. And it's, sometimes I think some people end up feeling like they're stuck between a kind of rock and a hard place. You know, do I stay in this relationship in my home where my children can go to school, or do I go to a refuge however many miles away, uproot my children, go and live, you know, with however many other families? It's really difficult. I think these decisions are not as easy as I think the kind of they look on the outside. You know, it's not just a case of being like, I want to look after my children and move away. But yeah, it's like lifting up your whole life, moving away from your family, away from your support network, taking your kids out of school. These are big, big decisions. I think it's really difficult.
And what about people that are apprehensive because they feel money's a barrier? What can they do to get people help? Like, what would the first steps be if someone was listening and, you know, one of the main reasons was financial stability?
Yeah, it's really, really difficult financial control, because we need money, right, to do anything. I think the key thing that I would say is a lot of women's charities. So I think you mentioned earlier Women's Aid. There's a few that I know, so there's Solace. I'm sure we could even put at the end of this podcast maybe some of the charities that women can reach out to, or any victim of domestic abuse. But a lot of these charities do offer, they direct you to where you can basically find resources that don't require necessarily having funds. So for example, whether it's, you know, staying at a refuge that you may not have to pay for, or soup kitchens, or sometimes they give vouchers out, you know, vouchers so that you can go and get your shopping, and so that you don't have to rely on bank accounts that you don't have proper access to. You know, I think that a lot of these, honestly, these charities make such a difference, and they plug the gaps that really the government should be, in my view, the government should be funding all of this. You know, this is where the government should be making sure that victims of domestic abuse are safe. It shouldn't at all be falling on charities, but they are doing, they're doing a wonderful job in
definitely
plugging that gap.
Definitely. This episode of Superpower State of Mind is brought to you by BetterHelp. This podcast and BetterHelp couldn't tie into one another more. We share a vision of therapy and what we want to achieve in the world. Taking care of our mental health is no different to looking after our physical health. It can be really tough to keep your brain in a problem-solving mode when faced with a challenge you just can't seem to work out, but when you do, it feels amazing. Therapy can help you become a better problem solver, making it easier to look after your mental health and work towards goals both small and big. For me, I could never confide in friends, so by speaking to a stranger, I realised that I'd poured and emptied out a whole load of emotions that were stored in my brain, and it created a super safe place for me. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try and aren't sure where to start, then BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, more affordable than some other therapies, and entirely all online. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/Marlin today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Marlin for 10% off your first month. So I'm going to move on to the next thing. And this really hurt my heart when I read it. And I read that you'd walked into a courtroom and you were mistaken as a defendant on like 3 occasions.
Uh-huh.
And I was literally like in awe when I read that, and I was thinking, wow, like what the heck? We're in 2022 and this is still happening, y'all. Like what? And I mean, you've come up, I'm pretty sure you've come up against a lot of racism in what you do, because I think you mentioned in an article that you barely see any black barristers when you work.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how do you deal with it? Does it make you more driven to achieve your goal? Like, does it push you forward to like be like, no, I'm gonna start something here and make a change?
Yeah, I think truthfully, I probably have days where I feel very driven, as you say, where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna be the change I want to see. You know, I'm gonna lead the way. I'm gonna encourage. Well, not lead. You know, actually, there are some fantastic. You know, I don't want to not give credit to the fact that there are actually some fantastic Black barristers who have gone out of their way to support me, you know, and actually that really matters. And I think it's not necessarily leading, it's kind of following in their footsteps to kind of guide those coming up behind me, if you see what I mean. And they've been fantastic. And sometimes I feel really motivated. You know, there's a wonderful Black female QC in my chambers, Barbara Mills QC, who I just look at and I'm just like, I want to be you, you know, yeah, you're just fantastic. She's always just got everything together. She's achieved so much, and I think having women like that who you can look up to, it matters so much. You know, the fact that there is one in my chambers, you know, there is literally one woman in my chambers who I can be like, I want to be like you. I think that we obviously need more role models, and that is going to come in time. And so I try to be a role model to the, you know, the generation behind me, and just be kind of really accessible. And like I always say to like students and aspiring barristers and stuff, like they all like DM me on Instagram and I'm like, that's just fine. Yeah, you know? It's really nice. Yeah, and it's nice. You know, I feel like I would have loved that. I'd have loved to just be able to like send a DM to someone being like, you know, someone messaged me the other day just saying, sending me a photo of their dress that they were going to wear to work. And they were like, do you think this is like, okay. And I was just like, I just love it. Like, I love that people feel comfortable enough to ask those questions, because it's the questions we all had. Do you know what I mean? Like, we all had those questions. So sometimes, yeah, go on, I do feel that. But yeah, other days I do feel a bit deflated.
No, I hear you. So what advice would you give to young women that want to follow in your footsteps and come into your field?
I would definitely say that there does have to be some resilience, because the bar is still quite outdated. It's still quite ancient. Honestly, I think it like it just I need to like refresh. I just think it needs like an update. And it's, you know, so many parts of the system are still, you know, people who've been doing it for 50 years and like it done their way. And you're going to come up against those people. You know, there's been sometimes even now I come across opponents who, you know, we'll be on the same case together. So I mean, we're clearly on the same case. We're clearly capable of the same things. And the way they speak to me is just as though, like, I'm not worthy of being there. And it used to really get to me. It really did. It used to kind of make me feel really insecure and think, oh my God, do people not think I'm good enough? And now I kind of, my attitude has started to change a bit. And actually I start to think that, you know, we are, like I said, we're here on the same case. If you don't think I'm good, what does that say about you? You know, we're both here on the same case. And I try to take it a bit more in my stride and try and almost sometimes like laugh at how ridiculous it is that like some people feel so entitled to be somewhere by virtue of their background, as opposed to working hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of weird. Like, does that make any sense?
Yeah, you know, it does. I don't know how you do it, because things like that would like, oh, I don't know, I'd react.
And it's hard, you know, sometimes the amount of times I've bitten my tongue, yes, I've been like, okay, not today, I want to keep my job, so let me just hold it in and I'll have a rant about it later.
But it says a lot about that person, right? And
yeah, exactly.
And, you know, sometimes you've got to feel sorry for them in a way and be like, I feel so sorry for you that you feel like that and you think like that still. And yeah, that you don't know any different, and you just have to pity them. And it's a strange world that we're living in. Yeah, like, yeah, I mean, oh, I don't even know.
I completely agree. Yeah, like I do. That's exactly how I've tried to start thinking about it. You know, I'm like, if that's really your view, like, then that is sad. Like, it actually is sad that you just can't see, like, the fact that, yeah, okay, you might have gone to a posh school, but, you know, how on earth does that make you better qualified for this job? And, you know, ultimately, what I try to remember is what really matters are my clients and what my clients think and whether they feel they're being properly represented and whether or not we're getting good outcomes. And that will drive me
you know, on a day where I'm feeling, oh, you know, this opponent is a nightmare or this judge is a nightmare, I'm like, actually, what's most important is my client, because this is their life. This isn't like a game. This isn't, you know, a business transaction. This is someone maybe not, you know, have their kids being taken away, or someone not, you know, being, or so, yeah, someone not being able to break up with their partner is in, you know, in quite a dangerous situation, or, you know, someone wanting to spend time with their kids who the other person has stopped them seeing for a couple of years. You know, it's really important stuff. And I kind of just have to like refocus sometimes and be like, it really doesn't matter the little passive aggressive comments that I'm getting from this person, because this is actually important stuff. So yeah, that helps.
You're doing amazing. You're smashing it. What are your plans for the future? Do you want a family? What are your goals? What's the legacy that you want to leave behind?
That is the question I'm still trying to figure out. So I think that, I mean, I really would like to start my own family at some point. I quite often have clients being like, do you have kids? Do you have kids? And I'm like, not yet. But no, I would like to. And I think, it's just hard with this job. It really is hard, because I think we see the like worst ends of the like, of a family, if that makes sense. You see it when a family breaks down. I'm constantly seeing family breakdowns. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, there is a happy ending, but you see all the trauma that people go through before the happy ending, you know? And so sometimes it's like, oh, this is a lot. It's a lot to do this in your personal life and your professional life. But yeah, I think I definitely do at some point. It's just going to... So now I'm finding the right time. I'm going to America, like I said, for a year. So that'll be a good time to reflect and think about what the future holds. Maybe America forever, you know? I don't know. Going with an open mind. Maybe we'll be seeing each other in America, Marlon. Maybe we'll be.
And lastly, how do you remain focused? What routines do you put in place for your own mental well-being? Like your day-to-day bits, like I journal, I meditate. What are key things that you have to do to keep your mind in check and keep yourself focused?
It's definitely something that I probably could do more of, to be fair. I think for me that I think what really, really helps is like being able to switch off at some point. And that's something that I definitely need to get a lot better at. But I find that actually doing things like writing, you know, I've written a book and I'm writing another one, and I think that stuff really helps, because it's like, actually, I need to switch off. I'm not doing my work. I need to do something different. I need to kind of get myself into a bit more of a creative mode and do something a bit different. So I'd say that sometimes helps, but I think the main thing that really, really helps is like spending time with friends and family. That honestly is like the main thing that allows me to just relax. You know, just like actually keeps me going, because if I notice when I haven't hung out with my friends for a long time, I suddenly feel it, and I'm like, I feel very overworked, I feel very stressed. And all it takes is me like going to see my, you know, one of my best friends has two little kids who are the cutest kids in the world, and you know, I'm like actually going and spending a day with them and just relaxing, and you know, like a couple of weekends ago I went and we'd like had a water fight in the garden, you know, like things like that. And it just switches you off from the seriousness of your job.
Yeah, definitely. There's no place at home, right?
Right. It's lovely. So yeah, that really helps.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Alex. You've literally made me smile. You're so positive and you're so happy. I love it. You're literally not the stereotype barrister at all. What the hell? Wow, what a powerful, infectious and driven person Alexandra is. She's already now out in America absolutely smashing it. Give her a follow on Instagram. You can find a link in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode. Make sure to follow so you get that as soon as it's released.